You're listening to the Northern Virginia Business Podcast. My name is Jessica Dubois.
And I'm Derek Wynn. Here, we chronicle the stories of successful business owners and executives who stand out from the crowd.
Whether you're driven by purpose or profit, tune in to learn how these leaders have built successful businesses,
helping to shape the landscape of Northern Virginia.
All right, good morning, Kevin. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Great to be here.
Hey, it's always good to connect with leaders in the business realm. And I want to first start with, you know, kind of how did you get to where you are today? Like, where did you start? How did you climb your way up? You know, tell us about Kevin at 16 and tell us about Kevin at today.
That's a great way to characterize it. I'm not sure I've thought about Kevin at 16 in a long time, but maybe it's a fun starting point. My backstory is a relatively straight line. I grew up, my family is all from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, so about 2 hours north of the DC area. And I made my way to DC from Harrisburg to attend Georgetown University, where I was in the undergraduate McDonough Business School there, and was a 1998 graduate of Georgetown. And obviously an interesting time and an interesting era. Fortunate enough to get an opportunity to play two sports for part of my time while I was at Georgetown. I played a couple of years on the football team there and played for 4 years on the baseball team there. And so, you know, if there's ever a question about any of the interesting things that I've done in the past, it was way in the past, a much different era and a fun time and a great student experience for me, and ultimately led to kind of where I am today by virtue of the finance degree that I got and the ability to interview for some great jobs and opportunities, and was fortunate to land a position out of school at an investment bank called Houlihan Lokey. And I've been doing the same thing ever since. So it's been a fun ride. And you know, it was a great opportunity for me to get out of a smaller city, although Harrisburg is the state capital and lots happens there. It's obviously a much different world and a much different environment than being in the metro DC area and all the opportunity that exists there.
I think you bring up an important point too, which is, you know, opportunity. You know, it's amazing the number of people who find great success in this region. They leave kind of where they came from and never kind of look back. You still go back, you know, like I say about New York, it's a nice place to visit, not necessarily live there. But tell me about like where you see opportunity today for you and the firm. So for example, like I know that, you know, you've had changes as a firm. Right. So tell us a little bit about where you see the opportunity for yourself and the company moving forward.
It's really been, I would say, a market or an area that has constantly offered up new and interesting, we'll call it opportunity for us, but really challenges, opportunity, you know, left and right turns along the way. And so much of it has to do with just what's been going on in the world around us during my 20 plus year professional career. You know, I entered the workforce at a time where, you know, the tech bubble was building. And, you know, before I made my, you know, first significant bonus, the tech bubble was crashing. And, you know, it just felt like I was at the wrong place at the wrong time. But ultimately, I was with a great firm and in a position where I had a lot of professional opportunity early on in my career. And, you know, the events of 9/11 were kind of the next mile marker, you know, in the world and in the business community here locally. And we just, in some ways, happened to be focusing on some of the right things at the right time, which was starting to build a practice around working with aerospace, defense, and government contracting businesses. And obviously those all existed in the 90s and the 80s. And, you know, there's lots of businesses that have legacies supporting the government for decades prior to that. But, you know, the events of 9/11 and the aftermath and the opportunity that was created for the industry to respond to that and the residual tail associated with that was pretty significant. And it was a pretty significant change point for me from a career, because it was so much opportunity to help government contractors or defense technology businesses or, you know, aerospace companies to really figure out how to build value or how to extract value when budgets were increasing significantly or the overseas contingency operations were increasing significantly and companies were just finding themselves in places that they hadn't anticipated, at sizes that they hadn't anticipated, with contract values that they hadn't anticipated. And so it really opened up and started to create a world where the work that I was doing was even more relevant than it had been in the years leading up to that. And so companies were merging, companies were being acquired, they were going public. We started to see private equity investors come into the industry and start to build that up. And so for me personally, you know, being early in my career and getting a lot of that experience and being able to kind of work through the maturation of the industry when it comes to finance or mergers or acquisitions or the things that I focus on, it was really just a unique time and a unique opportunity for me to get a lot of experience early on. And then it felt like it just never really faded away. And, you know, I somewhat joke about it now, just given where asset prices are, or if you look around and try to buy a home in this area, it seems outrageous what the prices are and how competitive it is and, you know, how much things have increased in value. You know, we've seen a lot of those same dynamics in the marketplace that we work in as well. And so the opportunity has never really faded away. There have been some ups and downs, some changes of administration that have had positive impact or negative impact. There have been, you know, some changes in how government budgets function or how they're allocated that has had some impact and created some opportunity. And so it's not been a perfectly straight line the whole way, but the ecosystem is so significant, you know, driven by the federal government, driven by, you know, sort of the business community in the DC area, that we've just, you know, it's like every time you turn around, it might be a little bit different, but you just feel like there's more there. There's more of an opportunity. And this past year, I've been shocked by how well the business community, I will say, in the areas that we focus on, enterprise technology, government, et cetera, have performed. I know not every sector's been that way. And sort of careful to just be mindful of the fact that not, you know, the past year has been really hard in so many ways, but so many of the businesses that we see have just been so successful at figuring out how to navigate these challenging times or to find ways to add value in these challenging times. And so it's just another example of something where you look at it and say, geez, if I thought a pandemic was going to roll in, I thought, you know, we'd see things, you know, be cut in half. And that's just not been the case. And I go back, you know, every 3, 5, 10 years, and you can see another circumstance where, you know, that was the case, where we've just been able to utilize a very healthy ecosystem to work through some challenging times and been presented a lot of opportunity as a result of where we focus in that kind of defense and government technology world.
I think one of the interesting parts that we get into with Gast is we often talk about these pivotal moments. And I think you just mentioned a couple, like, you know, early on, for example, in a career, you had the tech bubble, right? So, I mean, like for you and your role and what you do, I mean, I would have to imagine that was kind of like did I make the right move? You know, did you ever doubt yourself in that process? Was that like a pivotal moment for you that maybe drove you more toward, I don't really know if I want to call it value, but like with 9/11, is that part of that transition for you?
I was probably too young to have perspective at that point or to truly appreciate it. You're just scrapping and clawing and trying to find a way. I think a good example of that is in starting Kips DeSanto. You know, we started the business in May of 2007. And the global financial crisis basically was, you know, had started unbeknownst to most of us at that point in time, particularly, you know, a few entrepreneurs that raised their hand and jumped off to do something independently at that point in time. But 2008, 2009 were really game changers for our firm and for our sector and the industry. And if you remember what the challenges at the time were, it was the financial system was what was broken at that point in time. And that was kind of a scary thing for investment bankers who rely on capital to make transactions happen. You know, capital had dried up and, you know, we had been in business for, you know, really less than a year when it just started to get really complicated. And we thought we had a lot of great momentum. And then we're sort of sitting here watching Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers, you know, go away overnight in a heartbeat. And we weren't sure what was going to happen. And we had been in a growth mode. We had been in an invest mode. We had not had the windfall of, you know, all these great opportunities or fees or any of the things at the time. So it was a really tricky situation for us as a team. And I think it really helped us. A term that we use a lot now is resilient, right? It helped us build resiliency because you just looked at it and said, look, we've got to figure out our path through this. We can't worry about what's happening at a macro level. We can't worry about what's happening, you know, on Wall Street. You know, we have families, we have, you know, employees, we have people that rely on us and our clients and, you know, the ecosystem that supports them. And so I think it was an important time for us to go through that early in the life cycle. And it makes you appreciate a lot of the things that happen thereafter. If you do have success or you do have a moment where you kind of forget how risky it was or how risky it might be to run a business, you know, it was nice to be able to reflect on that and say, look, we lived through some tough times and, you know, we had some dark moments there where we weren't sure what was going to happen or how long that was going to last. But to tie back to the earlier discussion, it changed quick. Like the switch flipped back pretty quickly there. It was about a 6-month window where we weren't quite sure how the market was going to respond. But beyond that, it snapped back pretty quickly. Again, because of the types of companies that we work with and the type of industries that we focus on, they were relatively resilient in the face of a pretty massive financial crisis at the time. And I would say that the last 12 months was reflective of another, you know, just example of that same type of behavior. So in a long-winded way of giving myself credit for picking the right industries to focus on, which just happened to be luck, right? Having grown up in Pennsylvania, gone to school in DC and stayed here, nothing more than luck to be focused on those, but at least, you know, I can look like a genius on the outside because of the great sectors and the great companies that we get to work with and support.
I think this is a great lead into the current crisis that we're in. We've talked about the tech bubble, financial crisis, and now the pandemic that we're in now. And earlier you had mentioned that you've been surprised by how well companies in the defense, government, technology sector have performed during the pandemic. And it leads me to the M&A survey that you all just released on an annual basis. And the 2021 survey that I was reading through starts out with the stat that, you know, nearly 80% of the respondents to the survey say the U.S. economy will grow this year. And a majority of the respondents also expect M&A activity and valuations to peak in 2021. And so that leads me to ask you, like, has the pandemic impacted M&A activity? And if so, how?
It is very industry specific. And even in the areas that we focus on, the experience is different across, let's use aerospace, and kind of the local government contracting communities to characterize that. So in the aerospace sector, transaction activity came to a standstill in March of 2020. And deals have occurred in that space since then, but the volume and the size and the relative health of those companies and those transactions is much different than it was in January and February of 2020 and in the years leading up to that. And that's just sort of simple math, right? You look at an airport, it's half filled compared to what it was. You look at flight schedules for all the major airlines and they're half filled with what they were. And international travel is probably even less than that. If you look at how many aircraft are being utilized or are in service today, it's down significantly from where it was. And you know that whole world is changing. And I think there's a lot of questions and a lot of still data still to be determined as to when that recovery occurs. Folks are thinking in 23, 24, and 25 that we'll get back to the levels of travel and the levels of just overall aerospace trends and tracking that we see. But you know that takes a little bit of time to get there. And we just don't know how people are going to respond. We don't know how or whether there's a tail to the pandemic that's longer than what we think today, or if there's another version of this that pops up. You know, there's just a lot of question marks there. So M&A activity really has fallen off pretty dramatically as a result of that. And the activity that you do see is a little bit more, you know, I would say there's more distressed companies that are doing things to try to survive or to try to extend the lifeline. And so that's a sector that has had a very, you know, uneven experience and in a lot of ways just a very negative experience. And then in the government contracting world, sort of the local community is a good example of that. There was a pause, call it March 15th through about May 15th. So about a 60-day window in kind of that late second quarter or late first quarter, early second quarter of 2020. And then it just kind of bounced back. And it was almost as if that pause had never occurred. And it was in large part because the customer base evolved to a remote work environment or a staggered work environment without so much as a hiccup, without so much as a day off, which I think was pretty remarkable given the magnitude of people and systems and things that had to happen in that remote environment. And that's not across the board. There's certain pockets, you know, certain customers that have had more challenges because you have to have people on site or couldn't travel internationally. And so it's a generalization to characterize it the way that I did. But for the most part, it was a very seamless transition to the environment that we sit in today. And contracts continued to operate. New business opportunities continued to flow, both the requests for proposals, the submissions, the decisions. And we found that our client base really had a very stable experience through all that. Their growth projections may have been off for a little of what they expected for 2020, but not in a material way. There wasn't a major slowdown relative to what they were expecting for 21 or 22. And I mentioned earlier, you know, some of the challenges of, you know, 10, 11 years ago, you know, the financial system was not, you know, sort of in a position where it was strained going into this either. Obviously, some of that slowdown was to check and make sure. But once things started to flow, we found that the financing environment for companies in our sector, in that government contracting sector, it was very healthy. It was, frankly, more readily available financing than you might have anticipated or even relative to what had occurred prior to kind of March of 2020. And so most folks took that pause and then said, look, we're building for the long term. You know, it's still a good environment to be doing transactions as a buyer because of the lower tax rates that are in place today, because of the availability of capital and the need to reposition and modernize your business for the out years. And then from the client side, we typically function on the sell side in these transactions. You know, there was some incentive last year to get out there and do deals because of the potential for increased tax rates in future years, whether that's 21 or 22 or sometime down the road. You know, the sense was that as you came into a presidential election cycle, that one outcome versus the other might yield a different tax regime in future years. So there was some incentive for folks to push out and get deals done before that happened as well. And so there was just a lot of, you know, things that were supporting activity in 2020. And it feels like a lot of those same factors are in play here in 21. And we see it as a little bit even beyond just what the market factors are. The industries that we focus on, M&A is just a core part of the capital allocation of companies in the sector. And private equity has become a key component of building companies in the sectors that we focus on. And so you really have two, I think, long-term fundamental kind of supporting parts of this, which is we've got a really healthy buyer and investor universe that is actively looking to allocate capital towards M&A transactions. And you have an industry where mid-tier and large companies are incentivized to build new customer footprints, new capability footprints, and you can do it in a pretty thoughtful and a pretty financially responsible way. And so it feels like it's a little bit of an engine, a little bit of a machine now, where this is just a core part of what we do. It's how you adjust to a down market. It's how you take advantage of an up market. And you know, if we're anywhere in between, there's just plenty of folks that are looking to try to differentiate in a dull market or in a market where there isn't, you know, you sort of can't characterize it one way or the other. So even beyond things like tax rates and even beyond things like interest rates, you know, we've just found that the industries that we focus on are really mature in their view of how to use acquisitions to build value for their shareholders or stakeholders. And so, you know, we see public companies doing it, private companies, founder-owned companies, private equity-backed companies. They're all generally looking at this as a great way to build value. And in some ways, it, running a little counterintuitive, you can decrease risk by taking some of these shots on the M&A side of things. You can diversify your business. You can increase your ability to grow or your the access to pipeline opportunities and talent. That's been one of the great conversations that we've had with folks over the years. You know, this is such an amazing area. So many highly educated people, so many people that have great skill sets. But, you know, we're sort of, we live in a little bit of a bubble here and everybody knows everybody. So how do you get more talent, right? How do you get better engineers? How do you get folks that have cybersecurity expertise? You got to go and look for that. And maybe it's here, but maybe it's in Colorado Springs or Huntsville or San Diego or some other market. And, you know, we've just seen people try to get really creative and building out their team in that way as well. So lots of, I think, core things, fundamental things that really support M&A activity continuing to be a significant part of the sector. And obviously, we're very hopeful to be, you know, a key part of that going forward and leverage our track record and stay involved in it. And, you know, I always characterize our team as deal junkies. We all love being a part of this. We love helping our clients. We really enjoy, you know, sort of the process. It's hard and it has a lot of ups and downs that are associated with it, but it is, it's really a very exciting professional place to be and an exciting part to be kind of in the middle of all of that activity. And so we're hungry to kind of, you know, maintain our spot and build our market share and hopefully, you know, continue to be a big part of that in the areas that we focus on.
So you just brought up so many great questions for me, but I'm going to try to restrain myself here and I'm just going to go towards one direction. And that is on talent, because that really excites me. And because Derek and I are interviewing local political leader later on this week that we're having on the podcast. And the conversation, like one of the questions that we want to ask him is around the gig economy. And we know that based off of some stats, research that is done, that the gig economy is growing and it's growing at a pace that, as what has been said, is three times faster than the U.S. workforce. And in a study done by Accenture, they predict that a lot of companies in the future will look like a small C-suite that basically just contracts all of their workout or all of their employees. And I'm wondering if this is something you think about, or if you foresee, you know, the M&A activity being more about maybe the intellectual property that that company holds rather than maybe the workforce itself.
That's a pretty big topic. I don't know if I'm qualified to completely opine on that, but an interesting one. And I do, I mean, I think in the world that we operate in, the terminology solutions is used to characterize businesses that are more than just people and more than just technology. And I have found, my experience has been, when companies can merge the two or build a solution that really leverages those two core components, that those are the businesses that differentiate themselves the most, right? And, you know, terms like artificial intelligence or machine learning or data analytics or any of the buzzwords that are thrown around today to characterize next generation technologies or businesses or the positioning of companies. I think that's all super relevant and it is absolutely the future. But I think, you know, the one thing that I would just say through all of the things that we've seen and all the trends that we've seen is that no matter how significant the technology component is, it still takes great people and great talent in order to leverage that effectively. And, you know, the integration required, the transition to, you know, the new technology, the operations of it, the training that goes into it, no matter how automated the process can be, there's still a significant amount of either technical knowledge and support that's required to utilize it effectively, or management talent and support to take advantage of it in ways that actually do help businesses or help organizations. You know, just sort of pushing an enterprise technology platform into an organization only gets you so far. And I think from what we've seen is you can modernize it, you can, you know, adapt and adopt. And at the same time, you still need, you know, the people, the experts, the subject matter experts to be around it in order to make it what it has the potential to be. And so I think of it in that solutions context. And that's what, you know, a lot of our clients are really trying to merge the two together to be incredibly efficient and relevant with the changing technology, but to bring a level of expertise to the table that makes that technology as effective as it can be or as useful as it can be in those situations. And, you know, the age old version of this is, you know, a CRM, right? I mean, Salesforce is amazing and I, you know, it's an awesome tool, but for a lot of companies, it's only as good as the data that they can get in and get out of it. And so, you know, you have to figure out how to utilize those things effectively to get the most bang for your buck. And that's something that we see, particularly with our clients, if they're supporting federal, state, local governments, you know, those organizations aren't equipped to make those transitions without the leadership of our clients or the leadership of companies in those sectors that support them. So I think that there's going to be a mix. I think that that's really, some companies are going to go all the way as you described it, and some will stay, you know, in different buckets or brackets because that's what's most effective or useful for their clientele. And I think the businesses that are somewhere in between, I think will have a lot of success because the ability to really kind of get yourself associated with and become an expert in the technology platforms, I think that's just a great way to differentiate. And it's a great way to take advantage of a lot of, you know, creative, incredible things that are happening in some of those companies without having to be there at the ground floor and without having to make the investments. And I think that's one of the unique things about the DC area in particular is, you know, when people think about startups, you know, they think about Silicon Valley or, you know, maybe Austin, Texas. And we've just seen so many amazing technologies developed in this area and so many companies that the backbone of which are amazing technologies. And I don't think we get the credit for, you know, what we've been able to build here or the types of things that have been founded here because it's somewhat veiled by, you know, government funding or it's inside of a larger organization or it's not necessarily a consumer tool. And so, you know, you'll see more brand names that you recognize coming off of the West Coast, but maybe there's as much or better or even more creative technology here that might be, you know, utilized in a, you know, an aircraft platform for the Air Force that is just as cool and interesting and unique and valuable, but it's just not something that the average citizen might use or see or the average company might see. And so, you know, I think there's a lot of really incredible talent here and a lot of really incredible things that are going on. And you're likely to see more of that technology and kind of professional service, you know, merge together over time to create those solutions businesses. And that'll have a major impact on this area and this economy. And I think opportunities for me and probably for you guys as well, I would imagine.
Well, I think you, again, delivered a ton of great value there. I think you even gave us the title for the episode, which I'm thinking is going to be Deal Junkies. But, you know, like when you think about merging again, let's just say like the technology and the people, right? And you kind of bring those together. And if that becomes the thesis, right? Like if you're looking to maximize value as a business, you have to kind of bring all of that together. Can you give us a recent example of like, one of your clients you think did a really good job of that? Like, is that, I don't even know if that's possible for you to talk about, but like, can you let us know, like, who is a good case study in your opinion?
It's hard to say, and not that I don't have a good answer to it or don't have a specific, you know, item that you can point to. It's always different. And every company that we've worked with has gotten to that end line in a different path on a different timeline with different resources from a different starting point, you know, with different experiences in between. You know, some start and grow in a straight line, you know, and it's just an amazing experience. Some take 6 or 7 left or right hand turns along the way, and others have a unique experience in that they'll be building and growing and working, and then they'll have one kind of monumental contract win or, you know, something significant that happens to the business that will push them forward. So every one of them has been different and very difficult to kind of pin down what drove to that point, or, you know, a good example of that that's not, that actually is meaningful in the context of what you might do as a business owner. You know, the things that I've been most impressed by, or I think the thing that really drives a lot of this, is personality. And it's the, you know, sort of in our world, you know, we characterize part of our differentiator as our hustle, right? Just our get up every day and get after it. And, you know, you sort of, that's what the organization does. That's what the team does. And, you know, these people are incredibly talented and smart, but I think the hustle is just a big part of it. And I think in a lot of companies, it's that personality that ends up really kind of driving their success, right? It might be a meticulous CEO that's an engineer that drives a culture of, you know, process and milestone and, you know, risk-taking, but in a thoughtful manner. It might be, you know, a leadership team that's extremely cavalier and bets on everything and hits. And, you know, the culture of the organization is reflective of that. And then the growth of the organization is reflective of taking those risks and winning, or, you know, making bets that actually pay off. And, you know, and still others might be much more reserved, and, you know, you sort of see that reflected in the growth path or in how they've built their business and they've spent their money on their infrastructure or, you know, the indirect staff that supports them. And so I would think that, you know, you can't even say that there's winners and losers out of that, but that, you know, sort of a culture from the leadership team has such a huge impact on business success or business ability, or we can feel it when we meet with them and they talk about what they've done. And that's a kind of a fun part of the process for us, is getting to introduce our clients to a buyer or an investor and make that connection, because it oftentimes is, again, about capabilities or product or technology or customer or contract. But, you know, there's generally a fit. There's a feel that I think occurs. And that's actually been one of the interesting things about the last 12 months for us, is that we've done all of this via phone, via Zoom. You know, we've had in-person meetings along the way, but they've been very limited and or, you know, sort of specific to a certain situation. It's not the way that we did this before, where you would try to get, you know, all of these connections to be made in person. It's been one of the interesting things that we've had to adjust and adapt to in this environment. And so, yeah, I'm just a big believer in that personality and culture that have an impact on business success, and something that I'm curious about, and I would dig into if I was, you know, kind of a buyer and investor looking at a business and trying to understand kind of what the future might hold.
I think you bring up another important point there, and something I want to dive into a little bit, which is timing, right? So, you know, we continue to be surprised by, let's just say, the market, you know, as a whole. Just when we think things are great, you know, the rug gets pulled out from underneath us. Just when we think we're like in this hole and we're going to be there in this rut for months, there's a stimulus that comes through and it just bails everybody out and it just rebounds and goes back, right? But like from a business perspective, when you think about it, if you were a business and you don't know exactly where you want to go, but you think you want to sell at some point, like when do you start that conversation and who do you start that conversation with? I'll give you an example. I've walked into businesses before, they're a startup, and you say, yep, we're going to start it, we're going to grow it, we're going to sell it in 5 years. Like very clearly a plan behind that. And there's other times where, you know, they're just sitting there and they're waiting their time. And I don't know if they necessarily know when the time is going to get there. Like, how do they have that conversation with you? What would be your recommendation to a business, even if they don't know what they want to do?
Our role in that is to help people think outside of the business. And one of the ways that I characterize that is you spend most of your time thinking as an operator, as the CEO of a company, as the COO of a company, trying to build and grow and invest and do what you need to win more work, to sustain yourself, to collect receivables, to hire the right people, right? You're just sort of you're always focused on the operations of the business. And so that's a pretty natural place for people to be and very comfortable in a lot of ways. And then there's the other part, which is to step outside and think about it as a shareholder. Whether you are the shareholder or not, when you start to look at a business as a shareholder, you tend to develop a different perspective or different objectives, or you change your priorities as a result of that. And if you were running a public company, you'd be thinking about shareholder value. You'd be thinking about how, you know, should you buy back stock? Should you pay down debt? Should you acquire companies, right? You would look at this very holistically and think about how to increase the stakeholder or shareholder value over time. And I think when private companies take that step and start to think about it as a shareholder, they tend to develop a pretty healthy view of the business that is not necessarily how you run the business, but at least you know kind of what your ultimate goals and objectives are. You know, as a shareholder, if you said, hey, look, I want to own this business for 100 years, that would help you align your investment timing or the amount of money that you want to put into a company. If you said, I want to sell the business in 18 months, that's a whole different mindset. That there's a whole different way of thinking about it. And if you said, I want to sell it for a dollar, or I want to sell it for 100 million, that would influence the way that you think and do things as well, right? And so we find it important to be able to step outside and sort of have that look into the business. And that happens, you know, in my mind, depending on what stage you are at in the company. It might be once a year in the early years. It might be twice a year as you feel you're getting closer. It's not every day. It's not every quarter, because it can be very distracting to think like that in a private company where you don't have a liquid market for your stock or your ownership position, and it takes time to build value. And so you don't want to get distracted by that every day, but the ability to pull up and reset priorities or to set goals and focus areas based on, you know, what you're actually trying to achieve as a shareholder, I think is a really valuable way for people to think about it. And it's never too early to start that. I've had conversations with folks before they've started businesses and days after and in the first year or two. You can always sort of think about what you want to accomplish. You have to be a little flexible in those early years and adapt and adjust to what the opportunities are. But you can say, hey, here's where I want to be. Here's how I want to get there. Here's how I want to use capital, whether I want to bring in outside investors or not, or whether I want to bring in additional partners. And just being able to think through all those things is, I think, really, it's helpful to set a framework. It's helpful to put some boundaries in place. And so I would argue that it's never too early for that. And, you know, an investment banker is a great resource for that. You know, there's other folks, CEOs or retired CEOs that have been through these types of things, chief financial officers that have led companies that have leveraged the capital markets or borrowed money from banks or worked with private equity, just so you can get a different sense for what you're trying to accomplish. And if you're investing in your business, why are you doing that? What are the returns? And, you know, if you're not getting returns off those investments, maybe you should be doing other things. You know, we talk with the owners a lot about cash flow. And if you pull cash flow out of a business, sometimes there's a negative perception of that. But I've always argued that, you know, if you're investing it, great. If not, you know, put it into your, you know, your account at E-Trade or, you know,
Robinhood. Not Robinhood, definitely not Robinhood. You're
investing, maybe, maybe, you know, you can get better returns investing that way in other asset classes or doing other things. So try to look at it holistically, try to get people to think about it like they would an asset or like they might in a finance class or, you know, a capital markets class, something like that, just so you can get a different view of the world and you can start to square things up. I think the worst thing to do is to sort of not have that conversation for 10 years or 15 years and then say, you know what, I'm tired and I'm ready to go. And you'd say, well, if we could have talked about this 5 years ago, you know, you probably would have done these two things differently, or you may have gone in this direction and you may have changed your value proposition. Or maybe you could have, you know, pulled some money out of the business as the owner, and that would have changed, you know, your strategy or your timeline. Or, you know, maybe you would promote somebody on a different path or timeline to be the COO or the president of the organization as a result of that. So it doesn't always have to be about money or proceeds or value. It can just be about a lot of the planning that goes on inside a company to kind of step out of it and think about it that way. And some companies use boards of advisors for that. Some have official boards of director, and others have an advisory team or relationships, you know, like a Kip DeSanto or somebody like me to sort of rely on to objectively talk about those kind of things. There's no one perfect answer for it. I think a lot of it is, you know, what people find useful and interesting, and how they, or who they'd want to kind of talk through those things with. And, you know, it's a fun part of the job for us. You know, obviously we get paid to get the transactions done, but I would say that as much time as I can spend helping people through that is really personally very rewarding and intellectually very stimulating and interesting. And it is valuable to be able to see all of those different businesses, even when we're not working with them, so that we have as much of a top-down view of what's happening in the industries that we focus on as we can.
Well, and one of the things that I wanted to bring up, because I think you made a great point on how it depends on like what their goals are as a group, because these are conversations that we actually have with our clients when we're doing employee benefits, because we're like, how we want to create a 3 to 5 year plan, but we need to know your 3 to 5 year plan and how much risk and time and resources that they'll have available. So this is actually very aligned with what types of conversations that we're having with employers. I do want to pivot though and ask you a more like fun question. And that is like, we want to hear from you 2021 predictions. And this is not advice on your side. We'll go ahead and put a disclaimer there, but I would love to hear predictions on your side from M&A activity, industries in this region, kind of where you think we're going for this year.
And if you can't do that, just Northern Virginia as a whole.
Yes.
Yeah. No, yes. Look, I think this is an area that is set to have an experience similar to what I described, right? I think it's just going to continue to blossom, and there's going to continue to be a very strong business ecosystem here. And, you know, I think there's going to be changes, and some of those will pull back on some areas of maybe a federal budget, and others will get increased. You know, I think things like Amazon, you know, bringing HQ2 into the area, and, you know, just what some of the schools have done, and, you know, Virginia Tech and George Mason, you know, just in general, you know, some of the evolution of industries even outside of government contracting or the federal government that have continued to blossom. And yeah, it just feels like this region has so many different, you know, parts of it that are all capable of bringing growth and driving us forward. So I would say, or, you know, even just down to my own personal view, very optimistic about kind of being around Metro DC and in and around the communities that we focus on in aerospace, defense, and government, and think M&A activity is here to stay, as I said earlier. So we're optimistic about it, but it's bound to throw some, you know, curveballs at us or throw some challenges at us that we don't see and aren't expecting today. I mean, I admittedly didn't, you know, foresee 2020 going down the way that it did in January or in December of 2019. It just, you know, you heard about some things or you saw it, but I don't think I could have predicted or projected that, you know, I'd be working from home or, you know, have kids that didn't get to school for the last year or, you know, just, I don't know, any, you know, not see family, not travel the way that we're used to. I mean, that's been a pretty, just obviously a unique experience for all of us, but definitely didn't see it coming and would hate to portray myself as somebody who could predict or project what we're going to see here over the next couple of years. But we do see it kind of fundamentally being a great area and a lot of opportunity for all of us in the years to come.
Well, and how do you kind of consider those underlying or outside factors when you are talking to a client, like a buyer or seller? Because I think of like when outside factors play in, like I think of the stock market. So Derek and I have a lot of fun messing around with the stock market and, you know, talking about buys and sells. And there's so much of it is influenced by politics, what people like assumptions, speculation. And I'm just wondering how you play these factors in when you're talking to buyers and sellers, because you don't necessarily know what's going to happen when a new law is passed or when new administration is going to come in.
I think it's pretty fundamental, actually. I try to not let the tail wag the dog, maybe is a good way to characterize that. If the company's ready and it's the right time, we'll figure it out. You know, we've sold businesses for great valuations in the global financial crisis. We've did it when, you know, there were budget challenges and sequestration threats in 2013, you know, through administration changes and budget dynamics in 2016. And, you know, in 2020, you know, closing deals in March and April of 2020. So it's about the company. It's about the right timing is how I would generally advise folks and generally think about it. And, you know, if we stick to the fundamentals and worry about when it's that right window for our client, you know, the rest of that stuff is always going to be a moving part. And I think it's a slippery slope for us to get involved in trying to predict or project that. And, you know, what's Bitcoin going to do today? Or, you know, who's going to be the next company to announce that they've got a whole stockpile of some cryptocurrency? Or, you know, is the market going to be up or down? That's not, you know, I don't see that as our job. I see it as advising companies on helping them get through this when it's the right window for them. And if we stick to that, I think we'll be in good shape. So we're going to stay out of the prognostication business and just really try to be as great of an advisor as we can be to our clients, you know, in the moment that's right for them.
As I like to say, you know, the crystal ball got thrown out or broken last year, and now we just rely on Ouija boards.
Yeah. Well, the fact that you think it only got thrown out last year says a lot. So yeah. I appreciate your optimism.
Yeah. Yeah. The world keeps on getting stranger, you know? So I do think it's interesting. I mean, when you really break it down, you break down history, because it's like quantum computing, you know, things are just happening at a faster rate now. You know, like we used to think about these milestones being every 20 years apart. Now it's like every, you know, month, it feels like, you know, so this is all awesome. I mean, we really appreciate you coming on the show. Ton of great information here. I mean, I think any business that is working on their kind of, you know, long-term thesis for their business, I mean, there's just a lot to think about. So if folks are looking to get in touch with you, how would you recommend they do that?
At our website, we've got contact information there. So it's kipsdesanto.com, KipsDesanto.com. And a lot of good industry information and contact information for me or others out there as well.
Cool. Well, thank you, Kevin. Anything else you want to leave our listeners with today?
I'd just say thank you for what you guys are doing and for the opportunity to be a part of this. Very much appreciated.
Cool. No problem. Thank you.
Of course. Thank you so much.
Thank you for tuning in. You can listen to this episode and subscribe to future episodes on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to give us that 5-star review so that we can get our podcast out to more and more listeners. If you are a business leader or know of any business leaders that you would like to nominate to be a guest on the show, please visit us at thenovabusinesspodcast.com.